Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Known as the enemies to all nations, piracy flourished in the 18th century Caribbean, producing many of the buccaneers whose legendary names have gripped our imaginations to this day. Men like Blackbeard, Captain Kidd, and Bartholomew Roberts will go down in history for the undeniable role they played in shaping the outcome of empire in the 18th century. Yet piracy existed long before Blackbeard's name struck terror into the hearts of merchant seamen, and it remains a problem today. On this episode, we're discussing piracy in the Caribbean. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 1 of the series, we're discussing the frontiers of colonial America, the people and ideas that shaped it, and the events and places that changed its history forever. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we're discussing one of the most fascinating topics in all of the colonial world, and interestingly enough, a phenomenon that exists to current day. Of course, we're talking about piracy in the modern world, and how it shapes the policies and outcomes of empire in North America. I am extraordinarily excited about this episode, because it allows us to examine a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. Not piracy, per se, but the notion of outliers in empire. You know, when we think of empire, we think of a lot of different things. We think of flags, we think of wars, we think of colonies. And all too often, we can fool ourselves into believing that anything imperial only involves government structure. But it's not necessarily so, and piracy is a great reminder exactly of what we mean by that point. There are certain things that are results of empire, certain things that we can describe as outliers of empire. Imperial decisions affect them, and in this case, imperial decisions create them. But they aren't necessarily an intended consequence of some political leader in Paris or London or anywhere else in the European world for that matter. Empire is an extraordinarily connected event. It's something that trickles down to all different levels. And when you begin to really explore those different levels, you really start to see the full scope and scale of empire. So let's talk a little bit about piracy in the colonial world, because it's one of the most romantic and mythologized topics that we'll approach in this entire series. All of us have what essentially amounts to the same idea of what a pirate should look like, and what a pirate does. It is not unusual for us to picture a swashbuckler, a buccaneer, a bandit, someone that makes his own rules and works on his own schedule. We've always had this fascination with pirates, maybe because for too many of us, life tends to be a grind focused around someone else's schedule. But pirates always seem to be that little element of freedom that allowed us to more extensively experience a world that we really truly hoped existed once and allows our mind to wander back to it. But I can assure you, we will talk about pirates in a very realistic sense, in the way that historians would typically approach them. Because when you really begin to tear them apart, who they are, why they do what they do, how they became to be, and how they remain to this day, you'll see that piracy is one of the great constants that seems to exist throughout every empire. So first, let's talk about where pirates come from and how long they've been around. The answer to how long pirates have been on this earth is really as long as people have been shipping goods across the oceans. There are examples of pirates in the ancient world, the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans, the ancient Phoenicians, all worried about the fear of piracy. Because piracy is a natural product of a commercial market in a seafaring society. Anywhere you ship goods that are valuable, you run the risk that some people, some outsiders, some scoundrels, you may say, want to take advantage of your hard work and make it the spoils of that work their own. Piracy has been around forever. Hollywood has recently dipped its toes into the water of piracy as well, talking about the pirates off the coast of East Africa in Somalia, with the recent film Captain Phillips starring Tom Hanks. Piracy truly will never go away in this world as long as we're shipping at sea. And yes, you could make the argument that there are digital pirates stealing music and stealing software, but we're not necessarily concerned with that. But piracy goes hand in hand with a trade-based market. That's something we have to understand. If goods are being passed back and forth, there will always be individuals looking to take it and make it their own. But where do the romantic vision or the fantastic vision of pirates we have, say, for example, Pirates of the Caribbean, really come from? Again, it gets back to our perception of the pirate. We think of the pirate as a person absent of a disciplined world, a person who makes their own schedule and enjoys the fruits of their own labor. To the victor, truly, go the spoils. But what does that really mean? Where does it come from? Well, interestingly enough, in the Caribbean world, piracy develops from a place that we least expect. Piracy develops from the exact opposite of a lot of those virtues and values we often ascribe to pirates. Believe it or not, piracy actually stems from a war. Now, what is it about the Caribbean that makes it so great or such a natural place for piracy to occur? Well, the bad news. It's really not the Caribbean that is naturally a magnet for pirates, but it's what's going on there. Recall, in the 16th century and the 17th century, who the dominant superpower in the New World is. Of course, it's Spain. And Spain is becoming the dominant superpower in the world because of what they're pulling out of the rich lands of South America and Central America. That, of course, is gold and silver. If you were to be in the Caribbean in the 18th century and the 17th century, what you would see is a constant flow of traffic coming off of the mainland of Central America and South America, through the Caribbean, and on its way to Europe. Now, these ships, for the most part, would be Spanish. Because of the Treaty in Tordesillas in 1506, Spain has almost exclusive rights to the Western Hemisphere, given to them by the Pope. Now, they will be constantly pulling raw materials from the New World, and there would be a regular and steady flow of ships moving east to west and west to east, either loaded with fortune or empty, waiting to harvest the natural resources of the New World. We would see the equivalent of millions of dollars per week traveling to and fro across the Atlantic Ocean. If you are a pirate, if you are a person who seeks to benefit from finding these ships, capturing these ships, and commandeering these ships, taking advantage of what's on them, you want to be in the Caribbean. It's simply where the action is. If you went to the Caribbean in 2013, you would not find piracy being a major problem. And the reason is because the economy of the Caribbean isn't necessarily based on that sort of commerce anymore. Piracy is very big off the coast of East Africa. Piracy is also very big in the Straits of Malacca in East Asia, because that's where the vast majority of the world's seafaring trade are trafficked through. In the 17th century and 18th century, the same was true of the Caribbean. So piracy doesn't really have a geographic home. It goes to where the proverbial action is. And in the 18th century, that was what we would consider to be the Caribbean Sea. Now, where do the great emergence of pirates come from in the 17th century? Well, interestingly enough, it comes from, as I've mentioned earlier, an unlikely place. It comes from a war. What we can say about Europe in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries is that there is a constant struggle, a push and pull for power. The politics of the day are such that empires like the British and the French and the Spanish and the Dutch are regularly competing with each other, not necessarily on the European continent, but the larger worlds that the European empires have built. That includes North America, that includes South America, and of course, that includes the very rich and fertile islands of the Caribbean. Now, one of these wars in particular that we're going to talk very briefly about has a direct tie to the emergence of piracy in the Caribbean world, and it's a war that's known as the War of the Spanish Succession. In North America, it'll be known as Queen Anne's War. Now, how does this play out? Well, the War of the Spanish Succession, aside from its origins, because they aren't necessarily important for us in this regard, will largely be fought in a series of alliances. The English and the Dutch will square off with the unified forces of the French and the Spanish. Again, the origins aren't necessarily important for us, but what is important is that this is no longer going to be a war just fought in Europe, as most of them had been. This will be a war fought around the world. Anywhere that these powers have colonies, you'll see them go toe-to-toe in open warfare. The Caribbean, much like North America, is no different. Now, in the Caribbean, what you'll see is that the fighting tends to be a naval war, and all of these superpowers will flood the Caribbean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean that surrounds it with ships full of men anxious to fight for their respective crowns. And you'll see a great deal of fighting, and you'll see fighting for many years. The fighting continues, and it develops into its own system, or it develops its own rhythm. And the combat is fierce, and the combat is often. But there's a problem. Eventually, the war has to end. But when it ends, what does that say for the people who have effectively made their lives now in the Caribbean Sea? Well, make no mistake, they're still gifted sailors, and they're very much anxious to keep up the fight. Who they fight and why they fight isn't so important. But they do have to make an income, they do have to make a living, and they do have to take care of their families if they have them back home. The end of Queen Anne's War will leave the Caribbean filled with anxious, desperate sailors with no one left to fight. The natural recourse, as we'll see, is the great age of piracy that we all know and love. But what's the precedent for piracy? Well, I like to think of it in this way. Imagine if you have a war on land. Of course, you'll have your regular soldiers fighting your opponent's regular soldiers, but we know that's not all the fighting. We know there's irregular or guerrilla or insurgent warfare throughout most major modern conflicts. They involve people who don't wear uniforms, people who don't necessarily have the same indicators in their guns or their flags that your opponent generally has. Maybe call them light infantry, but they are an effective part of any campaign. Now, why wouldn't that same principle, if it applies so well to warfare on land, apply to warfare at sea? Well, the easy answer is, it does. Believe it or not, for most of the major naval wars of the 17th and 18th centuries, navies found it very effective to attack their enemies' commercial shipping with pseudo-militaristic sailing vessels. They would hire a ship with its crew to do nothing but attack enemy shipping, stop the flow of their goods, stop their income from coming into their worlds. That's the idea. It was effectively legal piracy. We call that privateering. But privateering was common practice in the 16th and 17th and 18th century worlds. A privateer was a legally commissioned pirate, given a document we call a letter of marque, which is effectively a license to pirate. And they were very, very effective, especially against the Spanish. Remember, by the time we get to 1660, we have English colonies in the New World. We have French colonies in the New World. But the Spanish are still numero uno in the Caribbean, Central America, and South America. So England and France, particularly, will find it to be very profitable in terms of limiting Spanish power because they all want to do it for different reasons. They all want to be competitive by attacking their shipping. It works very well. So the precedent for privateering exists. And when Queen Anne's War ends, what you have are a large population of very good privateers with nowhere left to practice their craft. Now, as I said in the beginning of the program, piracy is one of the great outliers of empire. It's one of the great unintended consequences of imperial ventures, because pirates, who become known as the enemies of all nations, are actually a creation of the very empires that despise them. What an amazing story. But let's talk about these pirates. Let's talk about how they operate. Let's talk about what daily life is like for them. Because what I found in most experiences, we have a very misguided, perhaps, understanding of what these people did and how they operated. At best guess, many historians will speculate that there were probably close to 2,400 active pirates in what we consider to be the golden age of piracy, in a broad swath from 1660 to 1730. So if you are a ship captain trying to make money for your empire any time during that 70-year period, what you have to understand is with that many people actively engaged in the act of piracy, it's a constant and real threat every second you're at sea. It's a very real issue. And even in their own time, pirates will be, although reviled by governments, beloved by many individuals back in England, back in France, even in North America, for their, again, adventures and exploits in the New World. Pirate literature, written by famous authors like Daniel Defoe, will become highly popular. Newspapers will sell thousands of copies telling the stories of pirates in the Caribbean world. But it actually goes far beyond the Caribbean, because what will develop as we get closer to the 18th century and as we get closer to the year 1715 and 1720 is a massive and profitable new trade that will bring even more ships into the Caribbean, this time not taking goods out, but bringing goods in. Unfortunately, those goods are human beings. We're talking about the slave trade of West Africa. Pirates will have a very real schedule ahead of them as far as being busy and being productive, and it will include not only traversing the waters of the Caribbean, but traveling the Atlantic all the way to West Africa. It's very uncommon to find pirates in the Caribbean in the 18th century that do not jump regularly from that world to the West African world to engage in and profit from the slave trade. Now, they aren't necessarily trading in slaves themselves, but they are seeking to benefit from the rich other supplies of goods moving back and forth. It's actually a highly complicated system, but it's a system that's well understood in its own time. So, how does one become a pirate? Well, pirate life is a difficult one, and we have to understand something very clearly about these people. We have our own visions of what life is like and who they were, but make no mistake, pirates are typically the lowest people you'd ever want to experience in your daily life. They're criminals. They're scoundrels. These are people that you would not want to cohort with. You would not want to pal around with. We have this vision of what pirates are in our minds, but in reality, these people are common thugs and common criminals, and they benefit often with fatal consequences from breaking and operating outside of the legal system. But why is it so popular, and how do they do so well? I mean, 2,400 people operating in total indicates that there's clearly some sort of sophistication to this world, and that would be true. Life on a pirate ship, although there is a captain, is in many cases what some believe to be the only real true democracy in the world before 1776. A pirate ship is typically a collection of people that make all decisions as a group. Yes, there's a captain, but he's voted on by that group. And no decision is made, whether it's going from point A to point B, or expelling one member of a crew or another, unless all parties vote on it. It is a, in some ways, pure democracy on a pirate ship. And we don't often think of that. And that's something that is worth some further investigation. Because the democratic virtue and the democratic value clearly becomes a major part of the American story. Now, if you're a pirate, you can't stay on ships forever. That's just not an effective system. Life on a ship in the 17th and 18th century is a difficult experience. You have no clean water. Food does not last very long. So you want to strike your prey as quickly as possible. But even if you pillage and plunder and even adopt some members of that crew into your ships, even sometimes, if it's a bigger and better ship, commandeering the ship as your new vessel, where do you spend it? You can't pull into an American port like New Orleans, Charleston, and say, I'm a pirate, and I'd like to spend this money that I've gathered breaking the law. You can't do that. Well, we have developed what we call pirate havens in the time. And these are truly and sincerely the wretched hives of scum and villainy in the region. There are cities like Port Royal in Jamaica, cities like Nassau in the Bahamas, cities like Tortuga on Hispaniola, today Haiti and the Dominican Republic, that become noted as being the hives, so to speak, of these pirate clans. It's where they spend their money, they drink, they carouse, they purchase affections from women who live there. It's truly the pirate's life. And these places will have very big reputations to live up to. For example, in the 17th century, Port Royal, Jamaica, is one of the largest cities in the entire English world, second only to London. Think of that. In the entire world, second only to London. And it's a pirate haven. Interestingly enough, Port Royal will be wiped off the face of the earth by a massive earthquake. It'll be completely destroyed, and to this day, rests at the bottom of the sea. Back home in England, those who scorn piracy refer to this as God's wrath or God's revenge, the modern Sodom and Gomorrah, removed from the face of the earth. It's a very compelling drama, but that's pirate life. And we don't want to embellish this story too much. We don't want to make it a fantastic adventure, because it really is not. There is no time from 1600 to really 1850, in some cases, that pirates are ever considered to be an asset by these empires. If they are privateers in a time of war, they are a huge asset, an almost incalculable asset. But if they are operating outside the scope of royal authority, it is clear across the board, regardless of what empire you're dealing with, these people are a problem that need to be removed. But individuals among the populace will become larger than life because of their exploits as pirates, and we know those names today. People like Bartholomew Roberts, people like Henry Morgan, Captain Morgan, people like Edward Teach, otherwise known as Blackbeard. These men, these names, will go down in history because of their exploits, imagine this, as the criminal element of the day. It's very hard for us to understand that, but there is a sense of glorification here. There is an admiration among the populace that these people exist outside the reach of authority, and then outside of the boring drone of everyday life, whether it be in England, Charleston, or Paris. So who are these celebrities? Who are these figures that we so often associate with this so unique and so exotic way of life as piracy? Well, I think no single individual better embodies the story of piracy than Edward Teach, otherwise known as Blackbeard. Whenever we think about piracy, especially in the context of colonial North America, I really believe Blackbeard as a figure stands alone, because he's one of the people that, more so than any other, ties the colonial world of North America to the larger economy of the Caribbean. And he does it by making frequent voyages back and forth. He's well known in the American colonies and well respected amongst the pirate class of the Caribbean world as well. And in his story, We also get colonial America in a microcosm, that is, colonial America to the average person who lived there. So let's talk about where the figure of Blackbeard comes from, maybe dispel some of the myths of this individual, and get a better glimpse into the world of the 17th and 18th century American life. Little is known about Blackbeard when he's born. It's very likely he's born in England. It's very likely he's initially drawn to the Caribbean by Queen Anne's War. But none of that is verifiable, because the paper trail, as we call it, is very much a cold one in this regard. When we consider where Blackbeard was likely to come from, most experts will say he's born in Bristol, in England. And why they choose Bristol is because, A, it is the second largest city in England, but also, more importantly, it's an emerging place of trade and seafaring commerce in the 17th century. Now, there is a lot of dispute over what his name actually is. Some will call him Edward Thatch, others will call him Edward Teach. The most common understanding of who he is Edward Teach. But if he's from Bristol, if he's from that world, we have a very good sense of who he is and how he envisions life at the time. There's a few things about him that we find interesting. Number one, it's very clear, based on the fact that his body, when he dies, is found with a letter addressed to him, that Blackbeard is literate. And that's highly unusual, because you're dealing with a time without a real sense of public education and a real value in the average person being literate. If you are literate, it means you're probably from a prominent family and prominent household of some kind. So he's an interesting figure. He is not an outcast from English society. That's very important. He's not a product of some criminal underbelly of the larger English world. He's very much a product of what the average English person, maybe even a little more affluent than that, would know in the time period. Now, we don't know how he gets to the Caribbean. Again, if we want to use him as reflective of other pirates of the time period, we'll say perhaps something like Queen Anne's War. But when he gets to the Caribbean, the cold that was initially very cold becomes very hot. When we first see Blackbeard, we see him as, where all pirates would begin, a lower class or lower ranked member of a pirate vessel. The man who's in command of this vessel is named Captain Benjamin Hornigold. And Benjamin Hornigold is what we would consider to be, even though his name is largely unknown in average American popular culture, to be a highly successful captain. He's got three ships, he's got a large crew, he has a reputation, and he is successful. Blackbeard may not work with him closely, but his earliest experiences at sea as a pirate are very much built into these early experiences with Benjamin Hornigold. He'll use the base of New Providence as a temporary home, as many people in the pirate class would do at the time, and he'll be part of many successful raids on many different vessels at the time. Benjamin Hornigold eventually will retire. He'll lead some of his men to a man named Stede Bonnet, and it's at this point that we really see Blackbeard truly emerge as a major leader in the time in the Caribbean world. He's not only learning as he goes, but he's climbing the social ladder. And he becomes a well-known figure at all of the major ports of the time period. Now, it's important we understand that the Spanish have ports all along Central America and South American coastlines. Places like Cartagena in Colombia, places like Portobello, places like the Mosquito Coast in Nicaragua, all are major ports and always targets for pirate vessels. But we also have to consider the threat that exists in North American ports, places like New Orleans, places like Charleston, and even sometimes as far north as places like Boston. We'll have pirates emerging from the sea from time to time, perhaps partaking in some of the activities of the city, but always very secretly. Pirates are not going to be welcome on shore in most places. They are criminals. They are, as we said, the enemies of all nations. And if you were caught as a pirate, you were punished in a very brutal and very public way. It is not uncommon to travel into a major American port or even back in London itself and see the rotting carcass of an accused and executed pirate dangling from the bridge and dangling from various ramparts in the city to send a very clear message. Piracy will not be tolerated. It's a hard life. Very much what we would consider a live by the sword, die by the sword scenario. Again, we must stress, Blackbeard's life is full of holes for the historian, but it might be that that makes him such a compelling figure. At any rate, Blackbeard will continue to climb through the ranks, and he will eventually gain control of his own ship and his own pirate crew. And he learns very quickly that piracy is a world that exists outside of the law, and in order to be successful, you have to break a number of rules along the way. Now, one of my favorite heists, you can say, of all of Blackbeard's, will occur in November of 1717. During that time, Blackbeard's ship comes across a French vessel known as Le Concord, or the Concord, we'll say, that's doing what ships of that stature would be doing on a regular basis, trading goods to and from various locations in the Caribbean islands, hoping to benefit her respective empire. But Le Concord was a much bigger vessel than anything Blackbeard had, and to capture it was very routine for a pirate in the day. Here's typically how it went down. Pirate vessels generally had a number of different national flags on their ships. They would fly any number of them at any given time, but one of the tactics they gravitated to the most was this. Let's say they're encountering a French vessel. They'll raise the flag of France that will allow them to get very close to the vessel with very little fear of piracy. As they do get closer, and typically close enough to strike, that flag will go down, and the individual pirate captain's flag will be risen. This is known as the Jolly Roger, and where that comes from is the corruption of a French term. The French initially called this flag the Joli Rouge, that is the playful red. But the English couldn't handle that exact pronunciation. So they made the Jolly Rouge the Jolly Roger. And that's what stuck. And Blackbeard's is very intimidating. Piracy, to be successful, is all about intimidation. Blackbeard's flag was solid black with a silhouette of the devil on it. He had a spike stuck through a heart. And that's the symbol you saw on Blackbeard's flag. And when the French vessel Le Concord saw that raise with the ship perilously close, they knew that they were finished. Now, Blackbeard's no fool. We can't pretend that pirates will capture these ships, pillage and plunder them, and destroy the vessels. For Blackbeard, Le Concord was a real catch. It's a much bigger ship than anything that he has. So what he does very simply is abandon his own vessel, climb aboard Le Concord, and rename it. He makes that his flagship. And the name is something immediately out of popular literature. It's something you'd see in a film. It's almost poetic. He renames Le Concord the Queen Anne's Revenge. And the Queen Anne's Revenge immediately becomes the most famous pirate vessel in the history of the Caribbean world. It's an incredible and amazing story. But that's why we're so fascinated with this man as an individual. And with Queen Anne's Revenge in tow, and the ability to build a small fleet by doing exactly what he did to gain the ship initially, Blackbeard becomes immediately the most infamous pirate in the world. And his next plan is even more ambitious than anything he's seen yet. Blackbeard will blockade the American South's largest port, and that port is Charleston. And the reason he does it, and the way that he does it, will take his name in infamy forever. He blockades the entrance to the port itself. Nothing gets in, and nothing gets out. And very quickly, he captures a ship called the Crawley, and takes all of its members, many of them prominent members of Charleston society, hostage under the decks. Now, no one knows what Blackbeard wants initially. Everyone in Charleston is terrified, because it seems like this pirate has just taken the entire city by siege. And then what we see are his demands come out. He could demand money, he could demand wealth, He could demand any number of material goods that would have made him more wealthy. But the issue is he doesn't. He can do that just as easily at sea. What Edward Teach needs are medical supplies. He takes the entire city of Charleston hostage. For what? Medicine. Now, what does he need? Well, this is something that is never really expressly said, but most historians agree. Places like New Providence in the Bahamas, places like Tortuga, historically, in Port Royal, these pirate havens, are places where you can make a very good living if you are a woman with maybe flexible morals. And prostitution is a major problem at these ports. Well, it's very likely that Blackbeard's men were suffering from an entire cacophony of venereal diseases, which would make their seafaring life, we'll say, difficult, to say the least. That's what he demanded, and that's what he got. When the medical supplies were delivered, Blackbeard released his hostages and went back to sea. What a story, and how revealing is it about the day-to-day problems of life in the 18th century? But we won't go into the totality of Blackbeard's life. I have a feeling, based on some of the emails and requests that I've received, that Blackbeard will have his own episode of Wartime in the future. But we will talk about his ending. The end of Blackbeard comes in typical pirate fashion, a sword fight on the deck of his vessel with a man named Lieutenant Robert Maynard of the HMS Pearl. And of course, in the end, what happens? Blackbeard is not only killed, but he's also decapitated by the representative of the crown, the great enemy of peace and order in the world. Blackbeard is dead, and his head will swing from the bow of the Pearl, and it will be proudly displayed back in Charleston. That's the end of Blackbeard as we know, but again, it was very much a pirate's death. Now, we don't want to make his life something it wasn't, and we don't want to say that it was reflective of every pirate everywhere in the world. It just wasn't. We can say, however, that it was an extraordinary life, and it's lives like his, but also men like Calico Jack Rackham, Captain Henry Morgan, Stead Bonnet, and the others, that really make this time period a point of interest forevermore in the American psyche. And that's the issue of piracy, is that although we can seemingly easily trace its origins in the Caribbean world, the most glamorized version of it, it seems to be a constant throughout the world for all of human history. As long as human beings are trading at sea, as long as valuable goods are shipped from point A to point B, piracy is something that you'll always have closely tied to it. And again, we see this in our own modern world. Piracy doesn't disappear from the planet Earth. It's very important. We highlight that. But piracy will end in the Caribbean by about 1750. Now, why does that happen? Well, there was an effort by the unified empires of the world to combat piracy at all costs. But the issue really occurs that the Caribbean sort of winds down as the place where you see the majority of valuable and rich trade occurring in the world. That idea will very likely shift. The place where that becomes prominent will next be the Mediterranean. It always has been. I don't want to minimize the Mediterranean in this regard, but the Mediterranean Sea becomes the new base of piracy in the world. These are different kinds of pirates, but they operate for the same reason. These are North African pirates. These are largely Arab Muslim pirates, but they're pirates all the same. And they are equally damaging and equally troubling to all empires in the area. So, when we think of piracy, I would ask that you think of it not as something involving Johnny Depp and the Hollywood blockbusters, but really consider it for what it is. It is one of the outlier, unintended consequences of a larger imperial world, a commercial world. Empires need to trade to make money. They need to ship their goods around the planet. Piracy is a natural consequence of it. But we can't make this out to be a romantic life or a fantastic life or an adventurous life. Maybe in some cases, piracy did involve those things. But these people are modern criminals. They are the criminal elements of the world, people that most of us, if we're lucky, never see. But make no mistake, the thing that drives it, the motivation behind it, is greed, it's fear, it's desperation. Again, these are criminals. And the study of the criminal mind indicates that as long as there's human beings, there will be criminal behavior. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.